Welcome to the 120th edition of the Gooner Podcast. This is your host, David Udo, and we're recording on the Monday evening after the 3-1 home defeat to Aston Villa 48 hours before Arsenal face Fenerbahce in Istanbul. Many of our regulars are either on holiday or otherwise committed, so we've brought a couple of our semi-regular guests that will make more than make up for the absence of the likes of the Highbury spy, Mark Ollington and Don Sebastiano. Firstly, a regular contributor to Arsblog, Vital Arsenal and occasionally the Gooner itself. His appearance this evening reminds us that we have to ask him if he can do a piece for the next issue on his trip to Istanbul to see the first leg on Wednesday. So, with that question hanging in the air, it's a very, very warm welcome back to Mr. Tim Stillman.
Good evening, and the answer's yes, I'll be happy to.
Wonderful. Thumbs up from Cave, always a good thing. Next up, a man who's taken a fair bit of stick in recent days for urging that fans needed to be patient in their expectation of new signings on Twitter and Arsenal Fan TV. He'll have the chance to explain all soon enough, but for now, it's a hello once again to the Arsenal Supporters Trust board member, Mr. Tim Payton.
Hello.
Finally, someone who nailed his colours fairly firmly to the Wenger out mast quite some time ago and has been living in purgatory ever since. Now people are starting to actually agree with him, and it's good evening to the editor of the Gooner, Mr. Kevin Witcher.
Welcome to the dark side, all you recent converts out there.
Brilliant. Anakin Sky Udo, wonderful. So, if only there was anything to talk about, if only there was. Starting to my left, Mr. Payton, after your calls for patience over the summer and slightly thereafter, what actually happened to make the Sunday morning statement come out from the AST? Was the Villa game the straw breaking the camel's back?
Gosh, where to start on that? Clearly the patience ran out. Yeah. I think let's look at the summer in the context, and also in an even wider context of the last couple of years, where the Arsenal Supporters Trust has been analysing and providing the explanation of Arsenal's financial strength, which finally was acknowledged by Arsenal in the build-up to this summer as there being a war chest. And I mean, Tim might agree with this, both in public at meetings with the AST and fans and in private briefings, Ivan and the club assured us that there was big money to spend. Mm-hmm. I think the phrase, I can't remember if this was in public or private, was, we'll be like Bayern Munich. We could buy big players. We are ready to go early. We know who we're going to buy. Mm-hmm. At the beginning of the summer, the Arsenal Supporters Trust put in some quite strong challenge to the club about its governance structures and what its board should look like, and how we've only got a 5-person board, including a distant owner, mm-hmm. doesn't have characters like Fisman, Dean or Carr on it anymore, and we wanted to see improvement. But all the messaging from Arsenal was that it would come. So when asked about this, I gave some messaging about, give Arsenal a bit of time, don't get too agitated now, we won't put a statement out, we won't challenge on them, you know, had a bit of fun using the word patience, tell them to wait. And there were a couple of big bids in the period when we said they went big for Suarez. I'm sure you'll ask me about the gigantic cock-up on that.
Question, but, 27. You
know, as fans as being inferred, the influence that a big signing was coming, also the influence of a big signing from Germany, where they went big after both Lars Bender and Ilkay Gundogan, and then even then went back to Germany because we kept being told that Arsenal was looking in Germany with the backup of Gustavo, but it was Bender and Gundogan that he really wanted. So reassurance was being pushed out sort of officially and unofficially, and what seems to have happened yet again, and I think part of the reason everyone is so furious now, is Arsenal have got no goodwill left in the tank. You can have, as a club, a bad transfer window. It looks like Manchester United aren't finding it easy. But when it's your fifth or sixth bad transfer window in a row, the goodwill has gone. I expect United, obviously they've got the Moyes issue, but if the transfer window doesn't go that great, they are champions, for goodness sake. You know, their fans have been given quite a lot recently. And I got the feeling at the weekend that it's the tipping point for Arsenal fans. There is no patience. There is, oh well, he'll spend it in January. There is, oh, he's a great manager that's bringing people through. But it's just that this club has become dysfunctional. Can't provide transfers. And where the hell are we going? And it's just too much deja vu. It so looks like 2 years ago. It's uncanny.
Mr. Stillman, anything to add?
No, well, I broadly agree with all that, and as someone who's probably just about reached the tipping point, and someone who's probably, I consider myself as having been patient for the last kind of 4 or 5 years or so, because all the time I kind of thought that there was a plan, and I think we have made mistakes over the last kind of 4 or 5 years, and particularly in transfer windows, not least 2 summers ago. But I always felt there was a bit of mitigation, and I always felt it was kind of building to this point, like they were holding back and thinking, well, let's just cling on to the top four, and then, you know, when the scales tip a bit in our favour financially, that's when we'll make our play. And that's what I've been expecting for the last few years. And now that point seems to have arrived. And, you know, the club went fairly big on the messaging earlier in the summer. And I think a lot of us were convinced, right, OK, this is when Arsene Wenger makes his play. He's kind of, you know, for better or worse, tided us over for a few years. And, you know, I mean, why else did he want the new stadium if it wasn't to increase our financial kind of firepower? And now we've just reached this point, and for reasons I can't quite get my head around, we're in this kind of real stasis, and to be honest, I'm not even sure it matters that much why that is. It's interesting to talk about, but I mean, the facts are speaking for themselves at the moment. We went into the Aston Villa game on Saturday, we finished it with Ramsey at centre half and Podolski at left back. We started it with absolutely no viable alternative to Mikel Arteta, and we were just poorly prepared on the pitch. And whatever the reasons for that are, that to me is just an undeniable fact. And, you know, it just makes me wonder. Arsene keeps coming out and kind of saying, yeah, but it's, you know, it's really difficult to buy players that are better than we've got, and blah blah blah, and I accept that it probably is. I couldn't do it. I couldn't close a deal for Luis Suarez, but you know, I'm not getting paid £7.5 million a year, and it does make you think, why are we paying that kind of, if even if Wenger's right and it's literally impossible to do that, why do we need to pay him that sort of money?
I think Kev can tell us something. He's about to have a fit otherwise.
No, actually, I've actually got a question for Tim. Tim Payton. On Arsenal Fan TV, the away shirt opening, you said that Higuain would be coming for sure.
No, I didn't. I said that looked like the likely transfer, but if you go back and listen, I said that Arsenal was getting very interested in Suarez, and Suarez was coming into play, and well, watched this play on Suarez. I thought that the Higuain deal was very advanced, and the messaging was coming out on that, and they were talking to him. But if you go and listen to it, I actually say then that Suarez is coming into view, and they swerved into the Suarez deal.
No, you didn't say Suarez, in fairness. You said a big, big player, like a surprise.
But separate to Suarez, yeah.
Right, well, who was that?
Gundogan.
So Gundogan was a surprise?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. Aside from that, I mean, the reason we failed, presumably, to sign players is because we come in with insulting low bids. I don't think it's that difficult to buy players if you pay the right price. Mm-hmm. You know, if you pay enough money, you can buy anybody. Now, okay, we haven't got the money to buy Lionel Messi. We haven't got the money to buy Cristiano Ronaldo. But we've certainly got the money to buy pretty much most other players on the planet, if you accept that you've got to pay more than you want to. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody wants to pay more than they have to, but at the end of the day, if you want something, sometimes you've just got to stump up the cash. And the premium that you pay for being in the Champions League is that you are going to have to pay more for a player than a smaller club who are in for him if there's no competition. So it's not rocket science. Arsene is deciding how much we're going to bid, and he's not. The irony of this is that he's now going to be paying over the odds for players he wasn't particularly fussed about in June. He'd have been better to pay over the odds in June for players we actually wanted. Mm. But now every club knows we are desperate, we've got to spend money, and so we are going to be paying through the nose for players that whoever's left. Now, as far as I'm concerned, it's too late. Apparently Fellaini, his clause where you could have got him for 23 million is gone. But I mean, come on. Well, I mean, can you imagine Fellaini playing on Saturday? Do you think Villa, do you think for that first penalty Agbon Lahore would have just run through? He'd have taken him out.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, it's quite obvious we're crying out for that sort of player. It's not difficult.
Is this sadly the second time in 3 years? Sorry, the second time in 2 years this has happened, with us missing a release clause and Juan Mata and Dick Law being Costa Rica?
Another example of incompetence, frankly. I mean, given what these people are paid, it's absolutely shocking. I mean, you know, I know we'll probably, you know, I know Chris Hudson on Arsenal Fan TV, he had a pop at Tim, which was unjustified because the Trust have been critical. It's just the thing about Tim this summer is the patience thing. Obviously, Tim was misled, sold down the garden path by the club, you know, and he's got the flak for that. All right. However, the one thing that came to me from that was the passion, the genuine. The guy cares, and this is a thing about people who say piss off and support Spurs if you're criticising the current regime. In fact, it's the people who are criticising the regime that care more because they can see what's happening. They can see what's happening to our football club. It's not a football club anymore. The priorities are not winning trophies. The priorities are making money. And the board are still perfectly happy because the stadium is selling out. It doesn't matter if you're screaming your head off at the manager. You've paid for that seat. That protest isn't showing on the balance sheet. The one salvation this current situation has got is there is a groundswell. And it is actually quite negative PR. And that's something the club don't actually enjoy. And that's something which is certainly going to force them to spend money. There's no issue there. Mm. But ultimately, my fantasy is that it's big enough for them to actually say, maybe we've got something wrong with the way things are handled with this manager. Mm. Maybe actually it's time for a change. I mean, I hope to God they don't offer him a renewal. I really do, but I fear they're going to.
Well, to be frank, I'm really, really quite scared that he may not have already signed the deal. He just wants to get the transfer window out of the way before it's announced publicly. I really, really hope that I'm wrong. Anyhow, Kev's pointed out an awful lot of bad things about the club's current policy. Going back around the table to you, Mr. Payton, one of the points that Kevin also raised was that, look, we can do what we did on Saturday. There'll be 60,000 of us singing, spend some fucking money, everyone booing as soon as the final whistle goes. But notwithstanding that kind of protest, can a fan pressure group generally make a difference to our club's policies?
I think people come on to me and say you can't make any difference as the AST, and in momentous difference you probably can't. I mean, what does make a difference is empty seats or baying from all four sides of the ground. When it gets so bad, it's far bigger than what any group or movement can do. What supporter groups, and certainly what I hope the AST does, is almost help people inform judgment and come to their views. So scrutinise the accounts and tell people what's really there. Provide them with information about the club's reporting lines and structure. Provide meetings and opportunities to hear more of what's going on so people form decision. And yes, create advice. And one of the things, the Arsenal Supporters Trust has been around a long time now. People know people like Nigel Phillips, Simon Hill, Glyn Taylor, who provide very good financial and legal analysis, which gives us a platform in the media and gives us a voice and the opportunity to speak, because I think we've been consistent, informed, our information has been right. But we're only ever going to be a catalyst and a conduit to process. At the end of the day, clubs change their managers because they're not winning enough games, and that leads to discord from the fan base. And it's been 100 years of English football showing that. And people have said to me, it's not like Arsenal fans. One of our wise AST board members, Geoffrey Freeman, cut his teeth on the protests against Billy Wright. We got down to, was it 4,000 at a home game? So the fans voted then. Others can remember the Terry Neill protests. Darren Epstein's been telling me a lot about those in the Arsenal Action Group. But sort of protest comes out of shocking performances. Yes. And then in a way supporter groups get trampled almost in the rush. So, I mean, I'm sure Tim Stillman will have seen this. I've probably been on I'm certainly not in the Kev category in recent years, but I've not been that far away. I've certainly been a challenger and a critic and not happy. And on the whole, the criticism I've had is being too harsh, and in the last 48 hours everyone's trampled all over the top of me to be far more harsh, and that Tim Payton is a stooge, and how much does the club pay him, and there he's at. And I feel like I've kept a fairly consistent position. Everyone's moved from here to over there.
No, absolutely. I mean, let's say, God forbid, after the 3-1 defeat on Saturday, we go out to Turkey. God knows what our team's going to be and who's going to be in the defence. Isaac Hayden is said to be crapping himself. God forbid, we lose 3-0 tomorrow night. We manage to scramble a 1-1 draw against Fulham and then go out at home and get booed off in front of 6,000 people as Fenerbahce beat us at home.
Well, we've got two huge games, haven't we? We've got qualifying for the Champions League because of the income stream and the prestige that comes with that. Mm-hmm. And then we've got Tottenham at home.
Yes.
Yeah, every game's huge, but you know what I mean by that.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And who knows? My instinct, I don't know, I think Tim's going out there, so he's going to be one of the few, because it's a great damnation on Arsenal. I mean, they're not providing any travel for people to get out there. That's a separate issue. But what is a club if it isn't about helping everyone club together and get somewhere? But I think that they'll pull together, they'll throw everything emotionally, physically at the Champions League qualification, a bit like they did with Udinese, and then they'll be so spent that when Tottenham come, it just terrifies me. But my prediction would be, I don't know what you think, Tim, we'll drag ourselves over the Champions League line, but God knows what state we'll leave ourselves like for the league games in doing that.
I think that's true. The only the real hope is, though, that Tottenham also have a European qualifier in the immediate build-up, and I believe they're playing it two nights later than we are. So I'm sure they won't expend as much emotional stress on playing a Europa League qualifier against whoever it is they're playing.
But they'll probably have a luxury of being able to field a second-string team.
Look at their bench just against Palace, they would have beaten ours.
There is that. But I think the Tottenham game really, really could be, if the tipping point hasn't already been reached, then that game is really, that's going to be like a seesaw. Because if we win that, having come through Fenerbahce, then that just lifts the air and makes it a little bit more pleasant. If the worst happens, then, and we've lost against Fenerbahce and we don't beat Tottenham, then it's just going to be absolutely even more toxic than it already is.
I'll put the cards straight on the table. If that happens, surely Stan and his lackey Ivan, they have to sack Wenger at that point, don't they? Or at any point during the season, is that going to happen?
It just can't happen. You've got to remember, Wenger is a de facto board member. He's on the board, as good as.
Mm-hmm.
He's also celebrated all around the stadium. You know, it's actually what needs it. I think the only way he's going to go genuinely is a complete revolution whereby the board are toppled. But this isn't politics. This isn't Egypt or, you know, Iran or whatever. You know, we're not seeing Lenin's statue being pushed over. He's actually made himself almost unsackable.
Oh, Christ. What a title.
But maybe he won't be sacked. And, I don't know about the wisdom of sacking him in September anyway. It would entirely depend on if there was somebody out there who could come in. But maybe his contract running down, which only has, you know, less than 12 months to go now, I think that would be more likely. Not necessarily saying it'd be a racing certainty that they wouldn't offer him a new contract.
Or that he wants one.
Or that, maybe he doesn't want the flak after that.
I would agree with that. I think that while I think that the stubbornness in him would not see him go before a contract ended, part of the way he's become obsessional about certain bits of behaviour, like developmental players, like not spending big money, I mean, the concept of the contract has become another one. So I think that he will see the contract out, but at the moment, I don't think he'll put himself through what the next few weeks and months could be like with an extension if it doesn't go well. But the stubbornness and the sense of pride will see him to the end of this contract. And maybe if you think that's what's coming, and certainly the AST position was don't renew the contract at the moment unless things improve, the running down of the contract, I'd have that short of an evens now.
Yeah, I think it's much more likely. Whether it's because the club don't offer him one, I think, like you say, I think it's more likely that he'd just say, do you know what,
the club will be mightily relieved, but we don't have to face
exactly. It's kind of taken out of their hands, and he might think, I'm nearly 70 years old, I don't need, 60,000 people booing me everywhere you
It's a good summer for him as well, because if he wants to stay in football but slow down a bit, the international jobs come up because of the 2 year cycle after the World Cup. And actually, you know, he's probably, you know, you could see the FA snapping him up tomorrow to go into St George's Park and be part of their developmental structures, just like France and most countries in the world. And actually, I think his skill set is probably more suited to working with an under 21 team at international level, where actually money can't be a factor because you deal with what comes in and you coach and nurture and develop. This is a developmental manager in the age of a Galactico.
So we should take the fact that on Friday Ladbrokes had him as 66-1 being the next Premier League manager to lose their job. He's gone into 12-1. That's just a sheer coincidence, is it? And everyone
throwing that's just people putting bets on.
I know it works. I used to work there when I was at university.
I
didn't know if an awful lot of money had gone on it, and you know, out of nowhere they stopped taking money on a certain transfer because, you know, it's gone from 0 to 100 in 2 seconds. I was just wondering, that's all.
I don't know what the other two feel. The chances of, even if it went wrong against Fenerbahce and Tottenham, given this mantra he's had all his life about contracts, I just don't see him walking out on one.
No, he wouldn't walk out on one, and the board wouldn't have the bollocks to sack him.
Having said that, if it was the St Louis Rams, Kroenke would actually sack the head coach.
That wasn't mid-season, was it? I know their seasons are so short though that
it never happens in the NFL. No, fair comment. Overall, before we move into the transfer market talk with regards to players themselves, starting with you, Kev, and working to my left from there, your overall thoughts on the preparation for the season?
Well, it was quite obviously exposed by Saturday. Basically, we haven't got a squad. Mm-hmm. I mean, we got rid of a lot of players we needed to.
27 players.
Was very good. But that actually ties in with what has become a real cost-cutting philosophy at the club. And it's, you know, there's a cynical view that part of the reason we've left signing players so late is so we don't have to pay their wages for 2 months. I mean, I'm sorry, but actually, within the club, certainly outside of the playing budget side of things, apparently the cost cutting is pretty ruthless in terms of the staff and their employment terms and conditions, their contracts. Arsenal look to shave off every single penny they can from expenditure. Now that's partly, you know, you could see that maybe that has actually crossed over to the playing side if Gazidis has got his hands on certain aspects of it. And I'm tempted to think that he's the one who's really moved to get these players out because he's aware that they're just basically swallowing up money we don't have. Good to get rid of Deadwood. Nice start. Sure. Well done. Okay, so who's going to replace them?
Let's jump straight in there, shall we?
Yaya Sanogo.
Yaya Sanogo, but look,
Arsene says he's injury prone because you didn't expect too much.
Absolutely. Wenger's programme notes on Sanogo says that his injury proneness is such that he will have to be rested at times, as we know he is injury prone but is full of potential. He didn't use the words quality or skill at this particular time. Quickly, Yaya Sanogo, waste of time and money for everyone. Mr. Stillman.
I rode back on saying that until I see a little bit more of him, to be quite honest, because we've signed injury-prone players in the past and it's come off. We took a gamble on Overmars, for example.
Arteta.
Arteta, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's had a couple of... And in a very big respect, we've been lucky to get this far without him kind of breaking down. And for me, that's one of the more kind of shocking things about this window. I understand why, say, Luis Suarez hasn't gone through yet, if indeed it does go through, which I tend to doubt now, actually. I understand that's a difficult signing politically, financially, everything else, but you know, signing a backup for Arteta, signing a fourth choice centre half, I mean, they don't strike me as really, really difficult signings for a club that's our level with people that are paid as much as they are, our club. But I mean, going back to Sanogo, I mean, until we see a bit more of him, I don't know. I think that's a worrying admission from the manager before he's even got started.
Yeah.
That, you know, a boy of 20 is going to have to be used sparingly. I find that very worrying. But it might be a gamble that pays off, as it probably did with, say, Mark Overmars.
Mm-hmm.
Or it might be another Armory Bischoff or countless other kind of gambles that didn't work out.
It could be diabolical, if you will.
So you have to go back an awful long way to find a gamble that has this sort of Arsene Wenger signing that has paid off, don't you?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Interesting. Mark Overmars is a long, long time ago now. To
yes.
Him,
yeah.
You know, to be cited, and he was a proven international. Okay, he'd had the bad injury that they were starting to actually medical science was meaning they were far more treating them and bringing them back. Whereas I think 10 years earlier for Mark Overmars, and that was the end of your career, wasn't it? But it's just. It's like footballers left Arsene behind, which is sad because a lot of his values were good for the game. Mm-hmm. The concept of developing a player, signing a young player and knowing that on a 5-year contract you had 4 or 5 years, but you could mould a team and change it. Now, post-Bosman, post the growth of the super clubs with the media income, it's become much more about the manager, the impresario, the strong character. Mourinho is the classic that just directs about 14 talented but spoilt millionaires and manages for 2 or 3 years to get the most out of them until you're spent and you move on. That's not Arsene's model, but unfortunately it's the way football's going, and Arsene on his own is not going to turn the clock back, although it does appear that at the moment he's leading a one-man crusade to take us back 20 years.
Definitely.
And it's not working.
And with Ferguson gone as well, he is literally the kind of flame keeper of that old style of management now. He's the only one left, as it were, and that's one of the saddest things for me, I think, for someone who has been patient, I suppose, with the manager, is that for someone who, it pains me to kind of see this, that someone who was kind of hailed for his innovation when he first arrived, that he's actually beginning to look a little bit like a relic at the moment, which it saddens me, because I haven't had any great anger towards him. I've been more on the patient side with him, and I've not lost my rag with him yet. So yeah. I'm probably just coming to terms with the fact that I think his time's coming to an end. So I'm probably at a different stage of my kind of regards towards him, and I find it very sad, to be quite honest, at the moment. It's a bit painful.
Kev, do you think it could be kind of as it was towards the last 3 months of George Graham's reign, in the sense that it just becomes apparent he's taking it as far as he can? I mean, in his last 3 months at the club, Graham panicked and bought Chris Kiwamia, John Hartson and Glenn Helder, purely because there were three players he found who were available. As of today, it's being rumoured that the players we want are Williams, a 29-year-old centre-half who spent all of his career at Stockport and Swansea, Michu, who no one in Spain's ever heard of until last year, and Kabay, who Arsenal have apparently offered the fee that Newcastle paid for them, who essentially he's a direct copy of Arteta. As Wenger just, he's taking it as far as he can, he's losing the plot, as far as that's concerned.
Well, did he ever have the plot in recent years, is my point there. You can add the name Paul Pogba to that list, by the by, who I think would actually be slightly better in terms of stopping opposition coming through. He's a bit closer to Vieira, and we do need a physical presence, but he's very young. But then again, Vieira was 20 when he came. It is looking like a supermarket sweep again. The trolleys, I can hear the trolleys basically, as we did in 2011 after the 8-2. Shouldn't have reached this stage. In terms of, I mean, what was the question again? Sorry.
Towards the end of his time.
Is it like George Graham?
Yeah.
The funny thing about George, you see, people knock George, but people say the football was dire, okay? But actually, the last 3 seasons of George, 2.5 seasons, we won two cups in 93, we won the Cup Winners' Cup in 94, we were on the way to the final of the Cup Winners' Cup in 95. The one thing about George was, on occasion, when it mattered, he could get a result with his players. Even if he'd lost them to an extent, he still had enough in them to motivate those guys in the big games.
Mm-hmm.
The league was a distant dream. He couldn't... I mean, he'd lost it on the level of producing a team to win the championship, but he could still, on the day, get a result when it mattered if there was something winnable at stake. Mm-hmm. That actually has disappeared from Arsenal. In fact, it's the very big games where we actually completely don't turn up. So I don't see a parallel there. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing there is George had lost the players, in all fairness. They'd become bored. Things have become stale. Now, I'm not sure that can be possible at Arsenal because there's been such a turnaround of players. Mm-hmm. You know, if you actually look at the squad probably 3 years ago, I wouldn't be sure, but maybe two-thirds of them are gone. You know, I mean, if you look at the first team starting 11, there's probably about 65% who weren't there 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I don't think Arsenal necessarily, the players have got bored by him, but I think there might be an element now where players are different. They're so rich, you know, they've got it made, that it takes a bit more for them to respect a manager. And that's where now trophies are being won. Where a manager, as Tim said, can basically handle millionaires and motivate them. Mm. Now, this is why I, back in, after the Blackburn FA Cup exit, was saying, get Mourinho. The guy's finishing at Real Madrid this summer, just get him. Because what these boys at Arsenal need is, number one, organisation. You know, just basically some discipline in the team, which you didn't see on Saturday.
No.
And number two, a kick up the arse. Now, there's a couple of them who don't need it. You know, Ramsey's a great tryer. Wilshere's a great tryer. They'll give you effort, but they need a bit of organising, Mourinho style. You know, what actually pleased me about the run-in last season was we were seeing old-style Arsenal. Well, you don't. You make sure you don't lose before you go and win.
Yep.
You just lay that foundation. In one fell swoop against Villa, that just completely went out the window because Arteta wasn't there and Ramsey and Wilshere just haven't got the maturity to actually shield their defence. Mm. So you saw Agbonlahor running through at will. So Arsene is the wrong man to actually turn this thing around. We're now actually at rebuild stage.
Mm-hmm.
We need a new man to come in and just rebuild the team. It could happen quite quickly. If you got Jupp Heynckes tomorrow, by January you'd have a team that would actually be able to start winning matches that matter. But the longer we leave it, the longer the rebuild job is going to be.
Okay, let's stick with rebuilding. Mr. Payton, I'm going to give you £100 million to spend tomorrow.
I'll put it back. that's old school. We're moving on, aren't we?
which positions do you think we actually need to buy extra players for? Because everyone's saying spend some fucking money over and over again in the ground. But I don't know, I think it's safe to say after 20 minutes we all want a new goalkeeper, as the Barnum brothers seem to want Chesney back.
It's almost which position don't you need someone
for? Oh, that's
certainly if you want to build. There are priority areas where you would catch up. A goalkeeper, it just goes without saying.
Mm-hmm.
I believe this was on the agenda early spring, but Arsene wobbled and thought that the two Polish lads would still deliver. It's back to the developmental. You've stuck with them for so long. It's like waiting for a bus. It will come soon. It will come soon. Surely even he saw on Saturday.
Yeah.
So a goalkeeper. But going back to this tired coaching setup and the need for change, no point bringing in another goalkeeper without improving a goalkeeping coach and allowing a goalkeeping coach to actually do goalkeeper coaching.
Am I correct in saying that Jerry Payton was he was ill for like 3 months and Tony Roberts had to coach the U team goalkeepers and the first team keepers?
Oh, and he did the ladies goalkeepers as well.
Okay, right. I would have stepped in for that.
And you hear, I mean, you hear across the game people saying that goalkeepers don't improve at Arsenal, and the problem. But even Bob Wilson will talk about he had to bring his goalkeepers in for extra coaching, almost without telling Arsene, didn't he? And back, you know, I was going to follow on with this point about sort of the old style manager to the new style manager. Arsene is surely the only manager left still getting out there with a tracksuit and taking the coaching, not observing and joining in, but leading the coaching.
Yeah.
And it's just so old school to where the game has got to that you need bigger structures now, specialist coaches working with each other.
Yeah.
The manager is more like Ferguson wasn't doing that. Ferguson was wandering around at the edges and making the final call, and almost his job at the end was making sure the right coaches were in place.
Yeah.
But that's on goalkeeper. So yeah, would sign the goalkeeper, a good quality goalkeeper, because our defenders don't trust that lad.
No, not at
all. The fan don't trust him now. I think you need a right back, because partly for the longer term as well, because as good as Sanya is, mm-hmm. coming to the end of the year and the injuries have started to catch up with him, so you're building long term there. And Cole Jenkinson is a trier, but for me, just because you sleep under an Arsenal duvet doesn't make you good enough to actually be able to play for Arsenal week in, week out. You've got to buy a central defender. And I still think, people get sentimental, the two did well at the end of last year. I think that all good teams that win trophies have a great central defender, and we don't have a great imposing world-class central defender. A Sol Campbell, a Rio Ferdinand at his best, a Tony Adams at his best, a Company at his best. Look at what great teams have. So I'd have one in there. What I certainly wouldn't do is start the season with two of them.
Oh, no,
two of them, because they're going to get yellow cards and red cards, let alone injuries, aren't they? And we've seen it already. And then the final one for me, well, it goes without saying, a striker, and we may come on to it in a bit more detail. Luis Suarez was exactly what we needed, exactly the movement. He knows how to do it in the Premier League, which in Iguan was a bit of a risk. He's also got a bit of that nastiness to him, which Arsenal need a bit more of. You go back to the Invincible and the early Wenger teams, and they could put an elbow out and sort of dive and spit and some things that weren't that pleasant or that right, but they had steel and they had nastiness and
Dennis
hardness.
Dennis Bergkamp.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of. Yeah.
Well, of course, there was attitude there, wasn't there? There was that slightly nastiness that we want to win. There you go. All of them. And I think, Suarez had that. That was a tough call, but played very, very badly by Arsenal, even if I think the right call was made.
Yeah.
But if they don't buy in that position now, they got incredibly lucky with Oliver Giroud's injury record last year, although the guy played on empty in the final few games, didn't he? Clearly. But we talked about him a few minutes ago. If he goes down, in terms of the squad, it's this Sanogo expecting to carry the position. It's just not wrong. I'm not sure if I've spent £100 million yet, if Tim's got any gaps to fill in. Have I left you any budget?
Well, I'd certainly add a creative player, because I still think that Cazorla is the only one in that team who cuts defences open.
Yep.
I think Thomas Rositzky 5-6 years ago without his injuries maybe is that player, but I mean, we just can't. It looks like he's injured for Wednesday.
He summed himself up on Saturday, didn't he? He set up three really good chances, then fell over
and,
at the end.
Yeah, yeah. And I really think we need to supplement in that area, because we've got some good finishers in Walcott and Podolski, but none of them really create a chance out of nothing. And against the bigger sides, I think that's where we really struggle, because if you're an experienced quality side like Man U or Chelsea, you just say, well, the threat's going to come from Cazorla. So we just put two men on him, and that's Arsenal done for. But just going back a bit to the way the targets seem to have evolved for this summer, should we say, when we started off talking about Rooney and possibly Lars Bender and Suarez, and now it's, kind of the best of the mid-table in the Premier League. And I do wonder if that's just because Arsenal have tried perhaps all summer to bring in this big level of player that they believe will push them towards the title, and they've waited and waited this long, and now they think that's probably not going to happen now, so they're probably concentrating on, well, let's get the level of player that will consolidate us in the top four and, go again next year. Whether Arsene Wenger and the people behind the scenes are the people to make those kind of big transfers happen is very much up for debate, but if I was to take a guess, I'd say that that's where the club are at now. They probably think, right, we're not going to get Suarez, we're not going to get Rooney, we're not going to get Lars Bender. Let's build this squad out, give it, a bit of fourth place quality, but not necessarily first place quality, and let's try and just
start again next year.
Exactly.
So we did this podcast this time last year.
Yeah, exactly. And then perhaps revisit it next year. And I think that strategy-wise, that might be where the club are at the moment. Whether they should have arrived at this point earlier, I don't know. But we've given up 3 points effectively, which, if you're talking about challenging for the Premier League, is, you
know, you can only lose four. Indeed. Six at tops, and we've given up one, not playing any of the top three competitors.
Exactly. So in terms of winning the Premier League, not that I'm think anyone really thought that was possible.
But we were promised that in June. We were promised spending to be like Bayern Munich and a team that would be capable of winning the Premier League.
Indeed, and which Arsenal fan at the moment thought on Saturday, oh, that's 3 points, you know, out of the title race, and who thought that's 3 points off of the race for fourth, and who thought that's 3 points off of the race for the Europa League? And
Kev, you were thinking Man United lost their first game of last season, so it's okay, weren't you?
It's not okay. United were in a much better position after that.
That was it.
Additionally, it was away to Everton. So,
apart from that, it was exactly the same.
Not what you call a gimme.
Numbers that's been going around the press is, are we going to buy three players, four players, five players? Essentially, we appear to have settled on five, and I think that's sensible. And if we release 27, we only need to fill up about, well, less than 20% of that. Are there any five players in the world? Arsene keeps saying there are no players out there to buy. All of us, my team, his mystery team of scouts, they watch all the games you can imagine. They've seen every player in the world. Are there any players that you want? As an intelligent football-watching man who, with 21st century satellite television, can watch football from any country in the world, which we can do nowadays.
If only I had the time, but anyway, Tottenham bought Soldado, okay, for 26. I don't think they've actually paid that much, apparently, but they might do if he reaches certain targets. Soldado is an example of a player that would have improved Arsenal. I mean, it's a no-brainer. He's done well with Valencia for at least two or three seasons. He started for Spain in the Confederations Cup. He didn't have a great one, so in the end Torres got in. But at the same time, it's between him and Torres for the front spot in the best international team in the world. Mm-hmm. Okay, you take a slight risk, will he adapt to the Premier League, blah, blah, blah. But if you're going to pay 23 for Higuain, you can say, OK, we can justify 25, 26 for Soldado. Mm-hmm. And given the choice, he would have come to Arsenal rather than Spurs. I'm pretty sure we'd probably pay him more wages anyway. In terms of other players, I mean, I was reading earlier on, someone put a piece online about Newcastle players we should sign, not Kabayi, but we could get Colaccini, Tim Krul and Tioti. And those three players would actually fill certain of our current positional problems, and chances are you could probably get the three of them for a combined sum of something like 45 million quid. I mean, interesting to say, Tim earlier saying we've switched our focus from big names to small names. We could have got them both. You know, we did have 100 million. I know the figure 70 million.
Still have it.
70 million.
It's somewhere. It is. Maybe we just play that. Maybe we pile the banknotes up in front of the goal. Because we've got enough now that we could fill an entire goal.
We've got the money to have actually bought very well. I mean, even someone like Wanyama, as a squad player, certainly worth a look. I mean,
Southampton broke our transfer record today, yesterday. I can't.
Pablo Osvaldo.
And they've spent £36 million this year on three good players, and then their win at the weekend, they had three 18-year-olds in the team. I mean, they're showing Arsenal how it's done.
I'll tell you what Southampton have got is a manager who can put a team out to get a result. You've got a manager who will do a formation and a way of playing which makes sure things are tight. You know, they've got some bloody good results last year, once they got rid of Nigel Atkins, and actually ended up being fairly comfortable by the end of the season. Mm-hmm. And that's because the manager's an Argentinian defender. You know, so basically, maybe we should start thinking about Nelson Vivas to come in and take over from Wenger. I don't know. But it's interesting that they have that much faith in their manager to keep them up, that they are going to spend those kind of sums. You know, that's significant to me. Mm. Now, you know, we're actually got a manager who doesn't believe in himself almost to spend those kind of sums, because he's worried he might get exposed as a failure if he spends 100 million quid and doesn't land a title. You know, you've got to talk about belief all the time. I believe in these players. Believe in yourself. Believe in your ability to actually spend a bit of money and get something back for it in terms of an increased number of points. Mm. You know, I mean, Wenger's a nutcase to me. I mean, I think there's serious psychological issues there. Mm. I mean, I think the guy's on the edge of madness sometimes. And he's certainly done that to the supporters at the moment. I mean, go back to Chris Hudson. The guy was actually cracking up on that post-match. He was feeling it, you know. And that's what Wenger has done to this club. You know, and the board are equally culpable because they've allowed it to happen. They've allowed this power vacuum to fill. The other thing which we're going to get onto is Lady Nina Bracewell-Smith, who's been tweeting this weekend.
Yeah, and
not for the first time.
It's very interesting because to me, that woman underpins the potential long-term future of Arsenal in the decisions she's made. Mm. Number one, wouldn't it have been interesting if, back in 2007, she had accepted David Dean's attempted coup d'etat, gone in with Dean and Kroenke and overthrew the board? Then we would have had an interesting scenario, Kroenke, Dean and Lady Nina as the power players at Arsenal. God only knows what that would have turned out like, but would it have been the same? Would Dean have allowed Kroenke to dictate the way the club has gone? Decision two for Lady Nina was selling out to Kroenke when Danny Fisman died. Mm. If she'd have sold to Usmanov instead, we would have had a genuine power struggle, which could have gone anyway.
Well, it may even have put the balance of power in the hands of small shareholders and AST and Fanshare, because I think it would have taken them to roughly 45% each, give or take a percentage, and then they'd have been clambering around for the votes to put in the majority. Now, you might say that would have created the most unstable club in the history of football, or you might have said that you could have had some kind of beauty parade about what you're actually going to do for the team and how you're going to improve it. But yes, Lady Nina's quite a pivotal role. And when she turned down, perhaps this is why she's really bitter when she drinks her gin to go with her bitter and sends her tweets late at night, is that she accepted 11,750 from Stan Kroenke and turned down 14,000 the same night from Usmanov because of kind of family pressure and emotional pressure about the right thing to do was to sell to Stan Kroenke because it kept David Dean out.
Indeed. And the question I've got for Tim is, in the early days of Kroenke's involvement with Arsenal, before he was actually invited onto the board, Tim met the guy, I don't know, 3 or 4 times?
Yeah, over a couple of years.
What was your impression of the man at that stage in terms of his potential benefit to the club?
He was certainly more engaging than now. He clearly didn't understand English football. I used to look up a fact or two about the Nuggets because he would come alive, and if I mentioned their best player and what was happening there, it would probably be a bit like, you know, an American coming over here and asking me, you know, how Cazorla was getting on as a new signing. It would bring me to life. He doesn't get it, but he gave the right messaging. This was he'd identified Arsenal Football Club. It had this great new stadium. Mm-hmm. It had a good infrastructure in place. Remember, I mean, I can't remember when. I know you were one of the first to turn, Kev, but this was back in a time where a common view was, just don't do anything and let Arsene Wenger run everything and it would be all right. Mm-hmm. How things change back then. It was clearly someone that had bought Arsenal Football Club to make money as an investment. The hope was, I think, that he, in doing that, he would run it to its values and run it well, because you make more money than if you don't. What has disappointed me is the increased disengagement. I thought we didn't see much of him then, but clearly he was trying quite hard, because he was trying to ingratiate with the board, he was trying to ingratiate with the fans a bit. I thought we'd still see Stan 3 or 4 times a year, that there'd be a bit of dialogue. He had a very good chief executive called Paul Andrews, who you could work with and talk to. He went to run some rodeo show in Denver and has never been replaced, really. But it's been the silent Stan thing didn't come across quite so much. Then once he's got the club, he's not interested. And you talk to employees at Arsenal and they'll agree. He's not walked around Highbury House once to meet the key staff. He's not, apart from the showpiece photo opportunity, he's not been up to the training ground.
Right.
He hasn't, I think he went to Chelsea. He's not been to an away game other than that. I happen to know through work connections a couple of directors of Everton, and they say it's almost tragic to see a great club like Arsenal arrive at their ground and have one director who's an employee. turn up. That wasn't like Arsenal used to be. That wasn't a sense of the club. But to answer your question, it's turned out more disappointing. We must also remember, and I don't want to divert necessarily this podcast away, but you know, Danny Fisman, who you could say made the decision, not maybe Nina, obviously, and made it on his deathbed. And I think, you know, so tragic. He did put everything into building that stadium. And I'd have convinced that if he hadn't have had the cancer, he'd have stayed around and tried to manage this club and tried to balance these people have bought in, but kept the balance of power, kept the custodianship. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe he'd have let Arsenal get like this. I think it'd have helped him more and he'd have seen what was going on.
Sure.
But Danny Fisman wasn't given a great choice at the end. Mm. It was a choice of Stan Kroenke or Ilya Usmanov. You know, it was realistically, we set up Fanshare 25 years too late. We didn't have the wherewithal to get there. We must always remember some of the choices that were being made. But the absentee owner is probably the most dangerous of all for a football club. We all know, to a certain extent, you've got to be on site. How can you really know what's going on at Arsenal if you weren't in that stadium, but also the extra insight they get being in the dressing room, being around the club? David Dean knew when George had sorted out the dressing room. He knew that Rioch never really got the dressing room. How can Stan Kroenke know that? I know Tim, and I think he's partly right here, but that's handed on to Ivan Gazidis to do. Mm. But Ivan Gazidis is beholden. I like Ivan, I think he does good work, but he's beholden to £2.25 million a year.
Yeah.
So how much does he actually, you know, he might well think that the time to move Arsene Wenger on is right by what he sees, but sure. He knows that Stan Kroenke has got this view that Arsene Wenger is this great coach. Does he dare say that?
Mm. I think the thing is with Kroenke's ownership, we've actually almost gone completely the opposite way to kind of what it used to be in terms of the fact that I think one of the biggest mistakes that Arsenal have made in the last 15 years is in the late 90s and early 2000s when we were really doing well. We kind of sat on our hands while Manchester United were off touring Asia, were off developing their commercial capability.
That was partly an Arsene call though, because Arsene was insisting at the time that you went to Austria.
Yeah.
True.
But you're right in terms of output.
In terms of, the kind of executive decisions at the club, I think that we were much too static, and that was when we were winning things as well, when we really could have made some hay over this competition with
Manchester United. And fairness, I think part of the reason for that was Manchester United's board had to be accountable to shareholders. They were on the stock market and they had to deliver dividends as well.
Yeah.
So for that reason, they actually had a board that was made up of a mixture of football people and business people and commercial people. And they, my God, they got it so right in terms of the way they exploited their products. Now, Arsenal were completely focused on the football.
Well, and although, again, if I defend them, they were focused on the stadium.
Well, no, that came later. The sort of the last half of the 1990s. That's when United started to sort of gear up. And now the stadium for us came in about 99, the start of the concentration on it. Took a few years, and then basically they obviously found the site of the Emirates. But even initially, because David Dean was effectively in charge, we were solely focused on the football side, which is fair enough on one level, and it did obviously bring its rewards. But at the same time, Dean should have realised that actually there's two things going on here at the same time, and if he kept tabs on United a bit closer, seeing what they were doing, we should have replicated that.
Yeah.
Now, by the time Danny Fisman took control, we were already lagging behind. And Keith Olderman was actually brought in, as much as anything, to be a bean counter so that the figures worked in terms of when we did have to actually arrange financing for the stadium. So then, obviously, yes. But even at that same time, if we'd had a couple of commercial people on the board, we could still have exploited the Arsenal brand a lot better than we did. And the reason we actually ended up making sure we had to move stadium was because we had to find a way of closing that gap on income on United. Because they were making so much more commercially, all we could come back with is making money on match days, which I don't know if we make more than United, but I think we've come damn close.
I think we do from a match-to-match basis. Am I correct in saying it's still circa £3 million for every home match?
It's neck and neck with what United make, and it is the great driver of our business model.
Okay. Right, no, on that note, sadly, it has to be time to wrap up.
Let Tim have his say.
Yeah. Okay, sorry, I apologise.
I was just going to qualify that point just by saying now we're completely the other way around, I think, because if you look at Kroenke's history, he is actually very good at the commercial side, and actually a lot of his business is media, is Arsenal Media, that actually brought him into the club because he saw the TV rights deals coming. That's what he saw coming, and he was quite right to see that coming.
He was correct
as well.
That's what he bought. Yeah. He bought a media company.
Exactly.
And he's been proven right. And the happiest day he's had in owning Arsenal was when Richard Scudamore opened the envelope from BT, which none of us saw a two-third increase in the domestic right. We knew about the only time I saw Stan Kroenke get animated, and it was when he said to me, "Wait till Africa gets satellite broadband, Tim." The potential. Now, in a way, he doesn't have to worry about that because Richard Scudamore and his team, who are amazing, they do all the selling.
Right.
Arsenal don't sell the media rights. They're all pooled and all given collectively. They've still got so much growth to go. So much growth to go in Asia, particularly in Africa. And also, it's really starting to move mainstream in the States as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
So... And American sports, I'll probably offend the listeners here, but they're dull as hell, aren't they? There's a reason why the world watches football so much more entertaining. It's going to keep going and keep going, which is why, and I don't know if this is a depressing way to end, but I don't think Stan Kroenke will sell. Arsenal coming fifth for 10 years in a row is still a lot more valuable proposition for Stan Kroenke because fifth in 10 years' time in the Premier League is going to be three times the size of now.
On that note, that does make it almost time to wrap up. But before we do, a few words about the first issue of The Gooner this season from our editor, Mr. Witcher.
Yes, it came out actually for the Emirates Cup weekend, and it's still on sale for the Fenerbahce and Spurs home matches. Because of when it came out, obviously there's not a great deal of topical material. So what we did, we kind of focused on a bit of retro stuff, such as... matches against Spurs that have happened over the years and that sort of thing. Basically, the Gooner has gone up in price to £2.50 now, the first price increase for something like 12 years. However, we do need your support out there if we are going to continue. So if you can buy it and give us a hand, we will survive long into the future. So please buy if you're going to the matches, or you can buy it online through the Gooner website.
Thank you, boss. Finally, the usual reminder that if you want to email us about anything related to the podcast, our address is goonerpodcast@gmail.com. And with that, it's goodbye from Mr. Payton.
Goodbye.
Mr. Stillman.
Good evening.
And Kevin.
Goodbye.
We'll be back in the latter part of September to reflect on what happens between now and then. Please all keep your fingers crossed that we do buy 5 world-class players. It promises to be an interesting time, to say the least. Until then, this is your host, David Udo, saying thank you for listening.
La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee, all good friends and jolly good company. Way!